to discuss a science feature for Spyglass. She consults her watch. 10 minutes ago. The launch speeches went on longer than I'd expected, so I slipped quietly away. I hope I haven't caused any trouble. Fei Li acts convinced. We can't have unauthorized people wandering around a sensitive research institute like ours. Louisa acts contrite. I thought signing in and having my bag checked was the security procedure, but I guess that was naive. Dr. Sixsmith will vouch for me, though. Just ask him. Sax and the guard both glance at Fei Li, who does not miss a beat. That isn't going to be possible. One of our Canadian projects needed Dr. Sixsmith's attention. I can only imagine his secretary didn't have your contact details when she cleared his appointments diary. Louisa looks at the boxes. Looks like he's going to be away for a while. Yes, so we're shipping him his resources. His consultancy here at Swanakie was winding up. Dr. Sax here has done a gallant job of tying up the loose ends. So much for my first interview with a great scientist. Fei Li holds the door open. Maybe we can find you another. 13. Operator. Rufus Sixsmith cradles the receiver in an anonymous suburban motel outside Buenos Aires. I'm having trouble placing a call to Hawaii. Yes, I'm trying to call. He reads out Megan's telephone number. Yes, I'll stay by the phone. On a TV with no yellow or green, Lloyd Hooks backslaps Alberto Grimaldi at the inauguration of the new hydro reactor at Swanakie Island. They salute the lecture theater like conquering sportsmen, and silver confetti falls from the roof. No stranger to controversy, says a reporter. Seaboard CEO Alberto Grimaldi today announced the go-ahead of Swanakie Sea. $50 million federal dollars will be poured into the second Hydra Zero reactor, and thousands of new jobs will be created. Fears that the mass arrests seen earlier this summer at Three Mile Island would be repeated in the Golden State did not materialize. Frustrated and weary, Rufus Sixsmith addresses the TV. And when the hydrogen buildup blows the roof off the containment chamber? When prevailing winds shower radiation over California? He turns the set off and squeezes the bridge of his nose. I proved it. I proved it. You couldn't buy me, so you tried intimidation. I let you, Lord forgive me. But no longer. I'm not sitting on my conscience any longer. The telephone rings. Sixsmith snatches it up. Megan? A brusque male voice. They're coming. Who is this? They traced your last call to the Talbot Motel, 1046 Olympia Boulevard. Get to the airport now. Get on the next flight for England and conduct your exposé from over there if you must. But go. Why should I believe? Use logic. If I'm lying, you're still back in England safe and sound with your report. If I'm not lying, you're dead. I demand to know. You've got 20 minutes to get away. Max, go. Dial tone. A droning eternity. 14. Jerry Nussbaum rotates his office chair, straddles it, places his folded arms on its back, and rests his chin on them. Picture the scene. Me and six dreadlocked freaks of the negroid persuasion, a handgun tickling my tonsils. Not talking dead-of-night Harlem here. I'm talking Greenwich goddamn village in broad goddamn daylight after a 16-pound steak with Norman goddamn Mailer. So there we were. This black bro frisks me down with his bitonal paw and relieves me of my wallet. What's this? Alligator skin? Nussbaum does a Richard Pryor accent. No fucking class, whitey. Class. Those bums made me turn out my pockets for my every last cent, literally. But Nussbaum had the last laugh. You bet he did. In the cab back to Times Square, I wrote my now classic New Tribes editorial, no point in false modesty, and got it syndicated 30 times by the end of the week. My muggers turned me into a household name. So, Louie, what say you take me to dinner and I teach you how to extract a little gold from the fangs of fate? Louisa's typewriter pings. If the muggers took your every last cent, literally, what were you doing in a cab from Greenwich Village to Times Square? Sell your body for the fare? You, Nussbaum shifts his mass, have a genius for missing the point. Roland Jake strips candle wax onto a photograph. Definition of the week. What's a conservative? The joke is old by summer 1975. A mugged liberal. Jake's, stung, goes back to his picture doctoring. Louisa crosses the office to Dom Grelsch's door. Her boss is speaking on the phone in a low, irate voice. Louisa waits outside but overhears.
No, Mr. Fromm. It is black and white. Tell me.
Hey, I'm talking now. Tell me a more black and white condition than leukemia. Know what I think? I think my wife is just one piece of paperwork between you and your 3 o'clock golf slot, isn't she? Then prove it to me. Do you have a wife, Mr. Fromm? Do you? You do. Can you imagine your wife lying in a hospital ward with her hair falling out? What? What did you say? Getting emotional won't help. Is that all you can offer, Mr. Fromm?
Yeah, buddy, you're damn right I'll be seeking legal counsel.
Grelsch slams the receiver down, lays into his punching bag, gasping, Fromm, with each blow, collapses into his chair, lights a cigarette, and catches sight of Louisa hesitating in his doorway. Life. A Force 10 shitstorm. You hear any of that? The gist. I can come back later. No. Come in, sit down. Are you young, healthy, and strong, Louisa? Yes. Louisa sits on boxes. Why? Because what I gotta say about your article on this unsubstantiated cover-up at Seaboard will, frankly, leave you old, sick, and weak. 15. At Buenos Aires International Airport, Dr. Rufus Sixsmith places a vanilla binder into locker number 909, glances around the crowded concourse, feeds the slot with coins, turns the key, and slips this into a padded khaki envelope addressed to Louisa Ray at Spyglass. Klug Building, 12F, 3rd Avenue, BY. Sixsmith's pulse rises as he nears the postal desk. What if they get me before I reach it? His pulse rockets. Businessmen, families with luggage carts, snakes of elderly tourists all seem intent on thwarting his progress. The mailbox slot looms closer. Just yards away now. Just inches. The khaki envelope is swallowed and gone. Godspeed. Sixsmith next lines up for an airplane ticket. News of delays lulls him like a litany. He keeps a nervous eye out for signs of Seaboard's agents coming to pick him up at this late hour. Finally, a ticket clerk waves him over. I have to get to London, any destination in the United Kingdom, in fact. Any seat, any airline. I'll pay in cash.
Not a prayer, sir.
The clerk's tiredness shows through her makeup. Earliest I can manage. She consults a teleprinted sheet. London Heathrow, tomorrow afternoon, 3:15 departure. Laker Skytrains, change at JFK. It's terribly important that I leave sooner. I'm sure it is, sir, but we got air traffic control strikes and acres of stranded passengers. Sixsmith tells himself that not even Seaboard could arrange aviation strikes to detain him. Then tomorrow it shall have to be. One way, business class.
Please, non-smoking. Is there overnight accommodation anywhere in the airport?
Yes, sir. Third level. Hotel Bon Voyage. You'll be comfortable there.
If I can just see your passport, please, so I can process your ticketing.
16. A stained glass sunset illuminates the velveteen Hemingway in Louisa's apartment. Louisa is buried in Harnessing the Sun, 2 decades of peacetime atomic power, chewing a pen. Javier is at her desk doing a sheet of long division problems. Carole King's Tapestry LP is playing at a low volume. Drifting through the windows comes the dim roar of automobiles heading home. The telephone rings, but Louisa lets it. Javier studies the answering machine as it clunks into action.
Hi, Louisa Ray can't come to the phone right now, but if you leave your name and number, I'll get back to you.
I loathe these contraptions, complains the caller. Cookie, it's your mother. I just heard from Beatty Griffin, who told me you split up with Hal last month. I was dumbstruck. You didn't breathe a word at your father's funeral or at Alphonse's. This bottling up worries me so much. Dougie and I are having a fundraiser for the American Cancer Society, and it'd mean the sun, the moon, and the stars to us if you'd abandon your pokey little nest just for one weekend and come stay, Cookie. The Henderson triplets will be here. That's Damien, the cardiologist, Lance, the gynecologist, and Jesse, the...
Doug?
Doug? Jesse Henderson? What does he do?
A lobotomist?
Oh, funny. Anyway, daughter of mine, Beatty tells me by some freak of planetary alignment, all three brothers are unattached.
On the hoof, Cookie. On the hoof.
So call the moment you get this. All my love now.
She ends with a suction kiss.
Mwah.
She sounds like the mother on Bewitched.
Javier lets a little time go by.
What's dumbstruck?
Louisa doesn't look up.
When you're so amazed you can't speak.
She didn't sound very dumbstruck, did she?
Louisa is engrossed in her work.
Cookie?
Louisa flings a slipper at the boy. 17. In his hotel room at the Bon Voyage, Dr. Rufus Sixsmith reads a sheaf of letters written to him nearly half a century ago by his friend Robert Frobisher. Sixsmith knows them by heart, but their texture, rustle, and his friend's faded handwriting calm his nerves. These letters are what he would save from a burning building. At 7 o'clock precisely, he washes, changes his shirt, and sandwiches the 9 red letters in the Gideon's Bible. This he replaces in the bedside cabinet. Sixsmith slips the unread letters into his jacket pocket for the restaurant. Dinner is a minute steak and strips of fried eggplant with a poorly washed salad. It deadens rather than satisfies Sixsmith's appetite. He leaves half on his plate and sips carbonated water as he reads Frobisher's last letters. He witnesses himself through Robert's words, searching Bruges for his unstable friend, first love, and, if I'm honest, my last. In the hotel elevator, Sixsmith considers the responsibility he put on Louisa Ray's shoulders, wondering if he's done the right thing. The curtains of his room blow in as he opens the door. He calls out, "Who's in here?"
"No one. No one knows where you are."
His imagination has been playing tricks on him for weeks now. Sleep deprivation. "Look," he tells himself, "in 48 hours you'll be back in Cambridge on your rainy, safe, narrow island. You'll have your facilities, your allies, your contacts, and you can plan your broadside on seaboard from there." 18. Bill Smoke watches Rufus Sixsmith leave his hotel room, waits 5 minutes, then lets himself in.
He sits on the rim of the bathtub and flexes his gloved fists.
No drug, no religious experience touches you like turning a man into a corpse. You need a brain, though. Without discipline and expertise, you'll soon find yourself strapped into an electric chair.
The assassin strokes a lucky cougarand in his pocket. Smoke is wary of being a slave to superstition, but he isn't about to mess with the amulet just to prove a point. A tragedy for loved ones, a big fat nothing to everyone else, and a problem solved for my clients. I'm just the instrument of my client's will. If it wasn't me, it'd be the next fixer in the yellow pages. Blame its user, blame its maker, but don't blame the gun.
Bill Smoke hears the lock.
Breathe. The pills he took earlier clarify his perception terribly, and when Sixsmith shuffles into the bedroom humming, "Leaving on a Jet Plane," the hitman could swear he can feel his victim's pulse, slower than his own. Smoke sights his prey through the door crack. Sixsmith flumps onto the bed. The assassin visualizes the required motions. 3 steps out, fire from the side, through the temple, up close. Smoke darts from the doorway. Sixsmith utters a guttural syllable and tries to rise. But the silenced bullet is already boring through the scientist's skull and into the mattress. The body of Rufus Sixsmith falls back, as if he has curled up for a postprandial nap. Blood soaks into the thirsty eiderdown. Fulfillment throbs in Bill Smoke's brain. Look what I did. 19. Wednesday morning is smog-scorched and heat-hammered, like the last 100 mornings and the next 50. Louisa Ray drinks black coffee in the steamy cool of the snow-white diner on the corner of 2nd Avenue and 16th Street, a 2-minute walk from the spyglass offices, reading about a Baptist ex-naval nuclear engineer from Atlanta called James Carter, who plans to run for the Democratic nomination. 16th Street traffic moves in frustrated inches and headlong stampedes. The sidewalks blur with hurrying people and skateboarders.
"Nothing for breakfast this morning, Louisa?"
asks Bart, the fry cook. "Only news," replies his very regular customer. Roland Jakes trips over the doorway and makes his way to Louisa.
"This seat free? Didn't eat a bite this morning. Cheryl's left me. Again."
"Features meeting in 15 minutes.
Bags of time."
Jakes sits down and orders eggs over easy.
"Page 9, he says to Louisa. "Right-hand bottom corner. Something you should see."
Louisa turns to page 9 and reaches for her coffee. Her hand freezes. Scientist suicide at BY International Airport Hotel. Eminent British scientist Dr. Rufus Sixsmith was found dead Tuesday morning in his room at Buenos Aires International Airport's hotel, Bon Voyage, having taken his own life. Dr. Sixsmith, former head of the Global Atomic Commission, had been employed as a consultant for Seaboard Corporation at the Blue Chip Utilities Swanakie Island installation outside Buenos Aires City for 10 months. He was known to have had a lifelong battle with clinical depression, and for the week prior to his death had been incommunicado. Miss Fay Lee, spokeswoman for Seaboard, said, "Dr. Sixsmith's untimely death is a tragedy for the entire international scientific community. We at Seaboard Village on Swanakie Island feel we've lost not just a greatly respected colleague, but a very dear friend. Our heartfelt condolences go to his own family and his many friends. He shall be greatly missed." Dr. Sixsmith's body, discovered with a single gunshot wound to the head by hotel maids, is being flown home for burial in his native England. A medical examiner at BYPD confirmed there are no suspicious circumstances surrounding the incident.
So, Jakes grins. Is your exposé of the century screwed up now?
Louisa's skin prickles and her eardrums hurt.
Whoops. Jakes lights up a cigarette. Were you close?
He couldn't. Louisa fumbles her words. Wouldn't have done it.
Jakes approximates gentleness. Kinda looks like he did, Louisa.
You don't kill yourself if you have a mission.
You might if your mission makes you crazy.
He was murdered, Jakes.
Jakes represses a here-we-go-again face.
Who by?
Seaboard Corporation, of course. Ah, his employer, of course.
Motive?
Louisa forces herself to speak calmly and ignore Jake's mock conviction.
He'd written a report on a reactor type developed at Swanee B, the Hydra. Plans for Site C are waiting for Federal Power Commission approval. When it's approved, Seaboard can license the design for the domestic and overseas market. The government contracts alone would mean a stream of revenue in the high tens of millions annually.
Sixsmith's role was to give the project his imprimatur, but he hadn't read the script and identified lethal design flaws. In response, Seaboard buried the report and denied its existence. And your Dr. Sixsmith did what?
He was getting ready to go public. Louisa slaps the newspaper. This is what the truth cost him.
Jakes pierces a wobbly dome of yolk with a toast soldier. You, know what Grelsch is going to say.
Hard evidence, says Louisa, like a doctor making a diagnosis. Look, Jakes, will you tell Grelsch?
Just tell him I had to go somewhere.
20. The manager at the Hotel Bon Voyage is having a bad day.
No, you may not see his room. The specialized carpet cleaner has removed all traces of the incident, who, I add, we had to pay from our own pocket. What kind of a ghoul are you anyway? A reporter? A ghost hunter? A novelist?
Louisa Ray buckles with sobs from nowhere.
His niece, Megan Sixsmith.
A stony matriarch enfolds the weeping Louisa in her mountainous bust. Random bystanders shoot the manager foul looks. The manager goes pale and attempts damage control.
Please, come through to the back. I'll get you a glass of water,
snaps the matriarch, knocking the man's hand away.
Wendy, water. Please, through here. Why don't you?
A chair, for goodness sake. The matriarch supports Louisa into the shady side office.
Wendy, a chair, this instant.
Louisa's ally clasps her hands.
Let it out, honey. Let it out. I'm listening.
I'm Janice from Esfigmenu, Utah, and here is my story. When I was your age, I was alone in my house coming downstairs from my daughter's nursery, and there, on the halfway landing, stood my mother.
Go check the baby, Janice, she said.
I told my mother I'd checked her 1 minute ago. She was sleeping fine. My mother's voice turned to ice.
Don't argue with me, young lady. Go check the baby now.
Sounds crazy, but only then I remembered my mother had died the Thanksgiving before. But I ran upstairs and found my daughter choking on the cord from the blind, wound around her neck. 30 seconds, that would have been it.
So you see,
Louisa blinks tearfully.
You see, honey? They pass over, but they ain't gone.
The chastened manager returns with a shoebox. Your uncle's room is occupied, I'm afraid, but the maid found these letters inside the Gideon's Bible. His name is on the envelope. Naturally, I was going to have them forwarded to your family, but since you're here... He hands her a sheaf of 9 time-browned envelopes, each addressed to Rufus Sixsmith, Esquire, care of Caius College, Cambridge, England. One is stained by a very recent tea bag. All are badly crumpled and hastily smoothed out. Thank you, says Louisa vaguely, then more firmly. Uncle Rufus valued his correspondence, and now it's all I have left of him. I won't take up any more of your time. I'm sorry I fell to pieces out there.
The manager's relief is palpable. You're a very special person, Megan. Janice from Esfigmenu, Utah, assures Louisa as they part in the hotel lobby. You're a very special person, Janice. Louisa replies and returns to the parking level, passing within 10 yards of locker number 909.
21.
Louisa Ray has been back at Spyglass's offices for under a minute when Dom Grelsch roars over the newsroom chatter, Miss Ray! Jerry Nussbaum and Roland Jakes look up from their desks, at Louisa, at each other, and mouth, ouch. Louisa puts the Frobisher letters into a drawer, locks it, and walks into Grelsch's office. Dom, sorry I couldn't make the meeting. Spare me the woman's trouble excuse. Shut the door. I'm not in the habit of making any excuses. Are you in the habit of making meetings? You're paid to be. I'm also paid to follow up stories. So you flew off to the crime scene. Did you find hard evidence missed by the cops? A message in blood on the tiles? Alberto Grimaldi did it? Hard evidence isn't hard evidence if you don't break your back digging for it. An editor named Dom Grelsch told me that. Grelsch glares at her. I got a lead, Dom. You got a lead. I can't batter you. I can't fool you. I can only hook your curiosity. I phoned the precinct where Sixsmith's case was processed. There's no case. It was suicide. Unless we're talking Marilyn Monroe, suicides don't sell magazines. Too depressing. Listen to me. Why did Sixsmith buy an airplane ticket if he was going to put a bullet through his head later that day? Grelsch extends his arms to show the size of his disbelief that he is even having this conversation. A snap decision. Then why would he have a typed suicide note and no typewriter ready and waiting for this snap decision? I don't know. I don't care. I got a publication deadline Thursday night, a dispute with the printers, a delivery strike in the offing, and Ogilvy holding the sword of what's-his-name over my head. Hold a seance and ask Sixsmith yourself. Sixsmith was a scientist. Scientists are unstable. We were trapped in an elevator for 90 minutes, cool as a cucumber. Unstable just isn't a word that sticks to the man. Another thing, he shot himself, supposedly, with just about the quietest gun on the market. A Rochford 34 with fitted silencer. Catalog order only. Why would he go to the trouble? So, the cops got it wrong, the ME got it wrong, everyone got it wrong except Louisa Ray, ace cub reporter, whose penetrating insight concludes the world-famous number cruncher was assassinated just because he pointed out a few hitches in some report. A report nobody agrees exists. Am I right? Half right. More likely, the police were encouraged to arrive at conclusions convenient for Seaboard. Sure, a utility company buys the cops. Stupid me. Count in their subsidiaries, Seaboard Corporation is the 10th biggest corporation in the country. They could buy Alaska if they wanted. Give me until Monday. No, you got this week's reviews and yes, the food feature. If Bob Woodward had told you he suspected President Nixon had ordered a burglary of his political rival's offices and recorded himself issuing the order, would you have said, "Forget it, Bob, honey. I need 800 words on salad dressings"? Don't you dare give me the I'm an outraged feminist act. Then don't give me the listen I've been in the business 30 years act. One Jerry Nussbaum in the building is bad enough. You're squeezing size 18 reality into a size 11 supposition, the undoing of many a fine newspaper man, many a fine anyone. Monday, I'll get a copy of the Sixsmith report. Promises you can't keep are not a sound currency. Apart from getting on my knees and begging you, I don't have any other currency. Come on. Dom Grelsch doesn't snuff out solid investigative journalism just because it doesn't turn up the goods in one morning. Dad told me you were just about the most daring reporter working anywhere in the mid-60s. Grelsch swivels and looks over Third Avenue.
Did he bullshit?
He did too bullshit. That expose on Ross Zinn's campaign funds in 64, you took a bone-chilling white supremacist out of politics for good. Dad called you dogged, cussed, and indefatigable. Ross Zinn took nerve, sweat, and time. I'll do the nerve and sweat. All I want from you is a little time.
Roping your pa into this was a dirty trick.
Journalism calls for dirty tricks. Grelsch stubs his cigarette and lights another.
Monday, with Six Smith's inquiry, and it's got to be hurricane-proof, Louisa, with names, sources, facts. Who squashed this report and why? And how Swanicky B. will turn Southern California into Hiroshima? Something else. If you get evidence Six Smith was murdered, we're going to the cops before we print. I don't want any dynamite under my car seat.
All the news without fear or favor.
Beat it.
Nancy O'Hagan makes a not bad face as Louisa sits at her desk and takes out Six Smith's rescued letters. In his office, Grelsch lays into his punching bag.
Dogged. Wham. Cussed. Wham. Indefatigable.
The editor catches his reflection, mocking him. 22. A Sephardic romance, composed before the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, fills the Lost Chord music store on the northwest corner of Spinoza Square and 6th Avenue. The well-dressed man on the telephone, pallid for this tanned city, repeats the inquiry. Cloud Atlas Sextet, Robert Frobisher. As a matter of fact, I have heard of it, though I've never laid my sticky paws on an actual pressing. Frobisher was a wunderkind. He died just as he got going. Let me see here. I've got a list from a dealer in San Fran who specializes in rarities. Frank, Fitzroy, Frobisher. Here we go. Even a little footnote. Only 500 recordings pressed. In Holland, before the war. My, no wonder it's rare. The dealer has a copy of an acetate made in the 50s by a liquidated French outfit. Cloud Atlas Sextet must bring the kiss of death to all who take it on. I'll try. He had one as of a month ago. But no promises on the sound quality. And I must warn you, cheap it ain't. It's quoted here at $120. Plus our commission at 10%. That makes... It is? Okay, I'll take your name down. Ray who? Oh, Miss R.E.Y. So sorry. Normally we ask for a deposit, but you've got an honest voice. A few days. You're welcome now. The store clerk scribbles himself a to-do note and lifts the stylus back to the start of Por qué lloras blanca niña? Lowers the needle onto the shimmering black vinyl, and dreams of Jewish shepherd boys plucking their lyres on starlit Iberian hillsides. 23. Louisa Ray doesn't see the dusty black Chevy coasting by as she enters her apartment building. Bill Smoke, driving the Chevy, memorizes the address. 108 Pacific Eden Apartments. Louisa has reread Six Smith's letters a dozen times or more in the last day and a half. They disturb her. A university friend of Six Smith's, Robert Frobisher, wrote the series in the summer of 1931 during a prolonged stay at a chateau in Belgium. It is not the unflattering light they shed on a pliable young Rufus Six Smith that bothers Louisa, but the dizzying vividness of the images of places and people that the letters have unlocked. Images so vivid she can only call them memories. The pragmatic journalist's daughter would, and did, explain these memories
as the work of an imagination hypersensitized by her father's recent death. But a detail in one letter will not be dismissed. Robert Frobisher mentions a comet-shaped birthmark between his shoulder blade and collarbone. I just don't believe in this crap. I just don't believe it. I don't. Builders are remodeling the lobby of Pacific Eden Apartments. Sheets are on the floor. An electrician is prodding a light fitting. An unseen hammerer hammers. Malcolm, the super, glimpses Louisa and calls out, "Hey, Louisa! An uninvited guest ran up to your apartment 20 minutes ago." But the noise of a drill drowns him out. He has a man from City Hall on the phone about building codes. And anyway, Louisa has already stepped into the elevator. 24. "Surprise," says Hal Brody dryly, caught in the act of taking books and records from Louisa's shelves and putting them into his gym bag. "Hey," he says to hide a jab of guilt, "you've had your hair cut short." Louisa isn't very surprised. Don't all dumped women? Hal clicks in the back of his throat. Louisa is angry with herself. So, reclamation day. Just about done. Hal brushes imaginary dust off his hands. Is the selected Wallace Stevens yours or mine? It was a Christmas present from Phoebe to us. Phone Phoebe, let her decide. Or else, rip out the odd pages and leave me the even. This is like a no-knock raid. You could have phoned. I did. All I got was your machine. Junk it if you never listened to it. Don't be stupid. It cost a fortune. So, what brings you up to town, apart from your love of modernist poetry? Location scouting for Starsky and Hutch. Starsky and Hutch don't live in Buenos Aires. Starsky gets kidnapped by the West Coast Triad. There's a gunfight on Buenos Aires Bay Bridge, and we've got a chase scene scripted with David and Paul running over car roofs at rush hour. It'll be a headache to okay it with the traffic cops, but we need to do it on location, or we'll lose any semblance of artistic integrity. Hey, you're not taking blood on the tracks. It's mine. Not anymore. Louisa is not joking. With ironic deference, Brody takes out the record from the gym bag. Look, I was sorry to hear about your dad. Louisa nods, feels grief rise and her defenses stiffen. Yeah. I guess it was a release of sorts. True, but only the bereaved can actually say so. Louisa resists the temptation to say something acidic. She remembers her father ribbing Hal, the TV kid. I am not going to start crying. So you're doing okay? I'm doing fine, and you? Fine. Louisa looks at the new gaps in her old shelves. Works good? Works fine. Put us both out of our misery. I believe you have a key that belongs to me. Hal zips up his gym bag, fishes in his pocket, and drops the door key onto her palm. With a flourish to underline the symbolism of the act, Louisa smells an alien aftershave and imagines her splashing it on him this morning. He didn't own that shirt 8 weeks ago, either. The cowboy boots they'd bought together the day of the Segovia concert. Hal steps over a pair of Javier's filthy sneakers, and Louisa watches him think better of making a funny about her new man. Instead, he just says, "So long, then." Shake hands, hug him. "Yeah." The door closes. Louisa puts the chain on and replays the encounter. She turns on the shower and undresses. Her bathroom mirror is half hidden by a shelf of shampoos, conditioners, a box of sanitary napkins, skin creams, and gift soaps. Louisa shunts these aside to get a clearer view of a birthmark between her shoulder blade and collarbone. Her encounter with Hal is displaced. Coincidences happen all the time, but it is undeniably shaped like a comet.
the mirror mists over. Facts are your bread and butter. Birthmarks can look like anything you choose, not only comets. You're still upset by Dad's death, that's all. The journalist steps into the shower, but her mind walks the passageways of Zadelhem Chateau. 25. The Swanakee Island protesters' camp lies on the mainland between a beach and a marshy lagoon. Behind the lagoon, acres of citrus orchards rise inland to arid hills. Tatty tents, rainbow-sprayed camper vans, and trailer homes look like unwanted gifts the Pacific dumped here. A strong banner declares, "Planet Against Seaboard." On the far side of the bridge sits Swanakee A, quivering like Utopia in a noon mirage. White toddlers tanned brown as leather paddle in the lazy shallows. A bearded apostle washes clothes in a tub. A couple of snaky teenagers kiss in the dune grass. Louisa locks her VW and crosses the scrub to the encampment. Seagulls float in the joyless heat. Agricultural machinery drones in the distance. Several inhabitants approach, but not in a friendly manner. "Yeah?" challenges a man with a hawkish Native American complexion. "I presumed this was a public park."
"You presumed wrong. It's private."
"I'm a journalist. I was hoping to interview a few of you."
"Who do you work for?"
"Spyglass Magazine." The bad weather lightens a little.
"Shouldn't you be writing about the latest adventures of Barbara Streisand's nose?" says the Native American, adding a sardonic, "No disrespect."
"Well, sorry, I'm not the Herald Tribune, but why not give me a chance? You could use a little positive coverage. Unless you're seriously planning to dismantle that atomic time bomb across the water by waving placards and strumming protest songs. No disrespect." A southerner growls, "Lady, you're full of it."
"The interview's over," says the Native American. "Get off this land."
"Don't worry, Milton." An elderly, white-haired, russet-faced woman stands on her trailer's step. "I'll see this one." An aristocratic mongrel watches from beside his mistress. Clearly, her word carries weight, for the crowd disperses with no further protest. Louisa approaches the trailer. "The Love and Peace Generation?" 1975 is nowhere near 1968. Seaboard has informers in our network. Last weekend, the authorities wanted to clear the site for the VIPs, and blood was spilled. That gave the cops an excuse for a round of arrests. I'm afraid paranoia pays. Come in. I'm Hester Van Zandt."
"I was very much hoping to meet you, Doctor," says Louisa.
26.
An hour later, Louisa feeds her apple core to Hester Van Sant's genteel dog. Van Sant's bookshelf-lined office is as neat as Grelsch's is chaotic. Louisa's host is finishing up. "The conflict between corporations and activists is that of narcolepsy versus remembrance. The corporations have money, power, and influence. Our sole weapon is public outrage. Outrage blocked the Yukon Dam, ousted Nixon, and in part terminated the monstrosities in Vietnam. But outrage is unwieldy to manufacture and handle. First, you need scrutiny. Second, widespread awareness. Only when this reaches a critical mass does public outrage explode into being. Any stage may be sabotaged. The world's Alberto Grimaldis can fight scrutiny by burying truth in committees, dullness, and misinformation, or by intimidating the scrutinizers. They can extinguish awareness by dumbing down education, owning TV stations, paying guest fees to leader writers, or just buying the media up. The media, and not just the Washington Post, is where democracies conduct their civil wars.
That's why you rescued me from Milton and his compatriots.
I wanted to give you the truth as we see it, so you can at least make an informed choice about which side you'll back. Write a satire about Greenfront New Waldenites and their mini Woodstock, and you'll confirm every Republican Party prejudice and bury truth a little deeper. Write about radiation levels in seafood, safe pollution limits set by polluters, government policy auctioned for campaign donations, and Seaboard's private police force, and you'll raise the temperature of public awareness, fractionally, toward its ignition point.
Louisa asks, "Did you know Rufus Sixsmith?"
"I certainly did. God rest his soul."
"I'd have put you on opposing sides."
"Or no?"
Van Sant nods at Louisa's tactics.
"I met Rufus in the early 60s at a think tank in D.C., connected with the Federal Power Commission. I was in awe of him. Nobel laureate, veteran of the Manhattan Project."
"Might you know anything about a report he wrote condemning the Hydra Zero and demanding Swanicky B be taken offline?"
"Dr. Sixsmith, are you totally sure?"
"Totally sure? No.
Pretty damn sure? Yes."
Van Sant looks edgy.
"My God, if Greenfront could get its hands on a copy..."
Her face clouds over.
"If the Dr. Rufus Sixsmith wrote a hatchet job on the Hydra Zero, and if he threatened to go public, well, I no longer believe he shot himself."
Louisa notices they are both whispering. She asks the question she imagines Grelsch asking. "Doesn't it smack of paranoia to believe Seaboard would assassinate a man of Sixsmith's stature just to avoid negative publicity?" Van Sant removes a photograph of a woman in her 70s from a corkboard.
"A name for you. Margot Roker."
"I saw her name on a placard the other day."
"Margot's been a Greenfront activist since Seaboard bought Swanicky Island. She owns this land and lets us operate here as a thorn in Seaboard's side. 6 weeks ago, her bungalow, 2 miles up the coast, was burgled. Margot has no money, just a few scraps of land, lands she's refused to part with, whatever inducements Seaboard dangled. Well, the burglars beat her senseless, left her for dead, but took nothing. It's not actually a murder case, because Margot's still in a coma. So the police line is that it was a poorly planned heist with an unfortunate end."
"Unfortunate for Margot."
"And pretty damn fortunate for Seaboard. The medical bills are burying her family. A few days after the assault, an L.A. real estate company, Open Vista, steps up and makes an offer to Margot's cousin for these acres of coastland scrub at quadruple its market value, to make a private nature reserve. So I ask Greenfront to do some research on Open Vista. It was registered just 8 weeks ago. And guess whose name heads the list of corporate donors?"
Van Sant nods in the direction of Swanicky Island. Louisa weighs all this.
"You'll be hearing from me, Hester." "I hope I will."
27. Alberto Grimaldi enjoys his extracurricular security briefings with Bill Smoke and Joe Napier in his Swanicky office. He likes the no-nonsense demeanor of both men, in contrast to the retinue of courtiers and petitioners. He likes sending his secretary into the reception area where company heads, union leaders, and government men are made to wait, ideally for hours, and hear her say, "Bill, Joe, Mr. Grimaldi has a slot for you now." Smoke and Napier let Grimaldi indulge the J. Edgar Hoover side of his character. He thinks of Napier as a steadfast bulldog whose New Jersey childhood is unsoftened by 35 years of Californian living. Bill Smoke is his familiar, who passes through walls, ethics, and legality to execute his master's will. Today's meeting is enhanced by Faye Lee, summoned by Napier for the last item on their unwritten agenda,
a journalist visiting Swanakie this weekend, Louisa Ray, who may or may not pose a security threat.
Sophie, asks Grimaldi, balancing on the edge of his desk, what do we know about her?
Fei Li speaks as if from a mental checklist.
Reporter at Spyglass. I presume we all know it. 26, ambitious, more liberal than radical. Daughter of the Lester Ray, foreign correspondent, recently died. Mother remarried an architect after an amicable divorce 7 years ago. Lives in uptown Ewingsville, BY.
No siblings.
History and economics at Berkeley, summa cum laude. Started on the L.A. Recorder, political pieces in the Tribune and Herald. Single, lives alone. Pays her bills on time.
Dull as ditch water, comments Napier.
Then remind me why we're discussing her, says Smoke.
Fei Li addresses Grimaldi.
We caught her wandering around research on Tuesday, during the launch. She claimed to have an appointment with Dr. Sixsmith.
About?
A commissioned piece for Spyglass. But I think she was fishing.
The CEO looks at Napier, who shrugs.
Difficult to read, Mr. Grimaldi. If she was fishing, we should assume she knows what sort of fish she was after.
Grimaldi has a weakness for spelling out the obvious.
The report.
Journalists have feverish imaginations, says Lee, especially hungry young ones looking for their first big scoop. I suppose she might think Dr. Sixsmith's death could be... How can I put this?
Alberto Grimaldi makes a puzzled face.
Mr. Grimaldi, fills in Smoke, what I believe Fay has too much tact to spit out is this. The Ray woman might be imagining we rubbed out Dr. Sixsmith.
Rubbed out? Good God. Really? Joe, what do you think?
Napier spreads his palms.
Fay might be right, Mr. Grimaldi. Spyglass isn't known for keeping its feet firmly rooted in fact.
Do we have any leverage with the magazine? Asks Grimaldi.
Napier shakes his head.
I'll get on it.
She phoned, continues Lee, asking if she could interview a few of our people for a day in the life of a scientist piece, so I invited her to the hotel for tonight's banquet and promised to make a few introductions over the weekend. In fact,
she glances at her watch,
I'm meeting her there in an hour.
I okayed it, Mr. Grimaldi, says Napier.
I'd rather have her snooping under our noses, where we can watch her.
Quite right, Joe, quite right. Assess how much of a threat she poses, and lay to rest any morbid suspicions about poor Rufus at the same time.
Tight smiles all around.
Well, Fay, Joe, that's a wrap. Thanks for your time. Bill, a word on some matters in Toronto.
The CEO and his fixer are left alone.
Our friend, begins Grimaldi.
Lloyd Hooks.
He worries me.
Bill Smoke considers this.
Any angles?
He's got a spring like he's holding four aces.
I don't like it. Watch him.
Bill Smoke inclines his head.
And you'd better have an accident up your sleeve for Louisa Ray. Your work at the airport was exemplary, but Sixsmith was a distinguished foreign national, and we don't want this woman to dig out any rumors of foul play.
He nods after Napier and Lee.
Do those two suspect anything about Sixsmith?
Lee isn't thinking anything. She's a PR woman, period. Napier's not looking.
There's the blind, Mr. Grimaldi. There's the willfully blind. And then there's the soon-to-be-retired.
28. Isaac Sachs sits hunched in the bay window of the Swanakie Hotel bar and watches yachts in the creamy evening blues. A beer stands untouched on the table. The scientist's thoughts run from Rufus Sixsmith's death to the fear that his secreted-away copy of the Sixsmith report might be found, to Napier's warning about confidentiality.
The deal is, Mr. Sachs, your ideas are the property of Seaboard Corporation.
You don't want to welch on a deal with a man like Mr. Grimaldi, do you?
Clumsy, but effective. Sax tries to remember how it felt not to walk around with this knot in his gut. He longs for his old lab in Connecticut, where the world was made of mathematics, energy, and atomic cascades, and he was its explorer.
He has no business in these political orders of magnitude, where erroneous loyalties can get your brain spattered over hotel bedrooms. You'll shred that report, Sax. Page by goddamn page.
Then his thoughts slide to a hydrogen buildup, an explosion, packed hospitals, the first deaths by radiation poisoning, the official inquiry, the scapegoats. Sax bangs his knuckles together. So far, his betrayal of Seaboard is a thought crime, not one of action. Dare I cross that line? The hotel manager leads a bevy of florists into the banquet hall. A woman saunters downstairs, looks for someone who hasn't yet arrived, and drifts into the lively bar. Sax admires her well-chosen suede suit, her svelte figure, her quiet pearls. The barman pours her a glass of white wine and makes a joke that earns an acknowledgement, but not a smile. She turns his way, and he recognizes the woman he mistook for Megan Sixsmith 5 days ago. The knot of fear yanks tight, and Sax hurries out via the veranda, keeping his face averted. Louisa wanders over to the bay window. An untouched beer sits on the table, but there's no sign of its owner. So she sits down on the warmed seat. It's the best seat in the house. She watches yachts in the creamy evening blues. 29. Alberto Grimaldi's gaze wanders the candlelit banquet hall. The room bubbles with sentences more spoken than listened to. His own speech got more and longer laughs than that of Lloyd Hooks, who now sits in sober consultation with Grimaldi's vice CEO, William Wiley. Now what is that pair discussing so intently? Grimaldi jots another mental memo for Bill Smoke. The head of the Environmental Protection Agency is telling him an interminable story about Henry Kissinger's school days. So Grimaldi addresses an imaginary audience on the subject of power. Power. What do we mean? The ability to determine another man's luck. You men of science, building tycoons and opinion formers, my jet could take off from LaGuardia, and before I touch down in BY... you'd be a nobody. You Wall Street moguls, elected officials, judges. I might need more time to knock you off your perches, but your eventual downfall would be just as total. Grimaldi checks with the EPA man to ensure his attention isn't being missed. It isn't. Yet how is it some men attain mastery over others while the vast majority live and die as minions, as livestock? The answer is a holy trinity. First, God-given gifts of charisma. Second, the discipline to nurture these gifts to maturity. For though humanity's topsoil is fertile with talent, only one seed in 10,000 will ever flower. For want of discipline. Grimaldi glimpses Fei Li steer the troublesome Louisa Ray to a circle where Spiro Agnew holds court. The reporter is prettier in the flesh than her photograph.
So that's how she noosed Sixsmith.
He catches Bill Smoke's eye. Third, the will to power. This is the enigma at the core of the various destinies of men. What drives some to accrue power where the majority of their compatriots lose, mishandle, or eschew power? Is it addiction? Wealth? Survival, natural selection. I propose these are all pretexts and results, not the root cause. The only answer can be, there is no why. This is our nature. Who and what run deeper than why? The head of the Environmental Protection Agency quakes with mirth at his own punchline. Grimaldi chuckles through his teeth.
A killer, Tom. An absolute killer.
30. Louisa Ray plays the ditzy reporter on her best behavior to assure Fei Li she posed